Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We'll examine the new president-elect's climate plan in the Climate Cast at 10 this hour. We're in depth on what President-elect Trump will do on a most urgent issue. And that's immigration reform, and the pressure will be on for three reasons. Our immigration system doesn't work for anyone, and it's needed reform for more than a decade. Donald Trump mentioned the issue on the day he announced for president and returned to it frequently, promising, among other things, a wall that Mexico would pay for and stricter limits on legal immigration. And his supporters will expect some kind of comprehensive reform plan, perhaps even within his first 100 days in office. So, what is an immigration bill that addresses the most necessary concerns and can pass the Republican-led House look like? Our guests, your view. Should the U.S. allow more undocumented immigrants away to full citizenship? Should undocumented immigrants have to go back to their home countries before they're permitted to apply for citizenship? And I'd like to hear from all of you with all of your political persuasions here. I'd especially like to hear from first and second generation immigrants, because I know your views vary on this issue as well. So talk to me about paths to citizenship. Talk to me about the idea of having to go back to a home country to apply. We can talk about the wall and some of the other ideas that Donald Trump has discussed when it comes to immigration policy. But I want to hear from you, whether you're Republican, Democrat, DFL, independent, and I'd love to hear from you if you come from a family of first and second generation immigrants. How have you been talking about this in your family? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, online at nprnews.org/live. I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Linda Chavez is with us. She's a columnist, writer, former staff member in the Reagan administration, and she is president of the Becoming American Institute. With us today from Boulder, Colorado. Linda, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be back.
Eduardo Porter is with us. He writes about economics for the U.S. for the New York Times, and is a columnist for the Economic Scene, and he's with us today from New York. And Eduardo, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. It's good to be here.
Linda, I saw something on your Twitter feed election night, and I wanted to ask you about this. You tweeted about Donald Trump's victory speech, and you said, missing from his speech so far, build a wall, Mexican rapists, ban Muslims, maybe he didn't mean it after all, I hope. Is that what you believe?
Well, I don't know, Carrie. I am really holding my breath right now, as I think a lot of conservatives who oppose Trump are. Many of us were reassured by people who knew him that it was all showmanship and rhetoric that he thought would fire up a crowd and that he really didn't mean it. And he has not said much since being elected president that really would give us much of a clue. He has said, apparently, that he's going to reach out to Mexican President Peña Nieto, but whether or not they will come to any agreement, I don't know. And I guess we're just going to have to wait and see.
Eduardo, the dilemma for President-elect Trump, if Linda is right and it was showmanship, or as many of these people around him say, is that he made commitments to voters who believed that, right?
Indeed, he did. I think his voters are expecting a wall and are expecting mass deportation. And I think that both these policies are very unlikely to be put in place because of just the massive difficulty, the massive expense, and the potential consequences of it. And so what remains to be seen is what will he do instead, and whether that will be sufficient to appease a base that I think really is expecting something of this magnitude.
Linda, Eduardo brings up the mass deportations. Now, there was a time when Donald Trump was talking about a deportation force. How do you understand what he meant by that and what he means overall on the deportation issue?
Well, first of all, it is a long legal process to deport people. You can't just round people up, put them in buses, and send them across the border. We did that in the 1950s in an operation called Operation Wetback. We did not then have the kind of advocacy groups, the strength of groups like the ACLU and other civil liberties groups to fight those cases. And in fact, there were periods in the 1930s, for example, when Mexico itself helped aid America in deporting Mexicans back to Mexico. And of course, it wasn't just Mexicans. It was their American-born children who were U.S. citizens. So he can't do that. He can't wave a magic wand. On the other hand, I guess I disagree a little bit with Eduardo about whether or not, yes, some of his supporters do indeed expect that. But apparently, according to exit polls, even a plurality of Trump voters believe that there ought to be some way to legalize the status of the 11 million undocumented who are here. So I think there is a consensus. Polls show that about 75% of Americans want to resolve the status of people who are here illegally, to allow people who haven't committed other crimes, who paid their taxes, who are upstanding members of their community, to be able to stay. So, you know, the question is how you go about doing that and how you go about convincing some of those hotheads in Congress who have made this a signature issue, Jeff Sessions being the top of the list. Right. And he, of course, is very close to Trump. So it's going to be a while before we know what's going to take place. But they're not going to start rounding up people tomorrow.
Linda, I have to say, I did not know about this operation that you talked about in the 1950s where people were.
Oh.
Yeah, this Operation
Wetback.
Operation
Wetback. And he, in fact, Trump himself spoke approvingly of it. He didn't call it by its name because that would, I suppose, have really offended people. But that's what it was called, and that's what the Eisenhower administration did.
Wow.
And it was also done in the 1930s, as I say, with the aid of, at that time, the aid of the Mexican government, who was happy to see some of their people repatriated back to Mexico.
Ivan says on Twitter, Trump has expunged the Muslim immigration ban from his website. Abir says, give all undocumented families and children in the U.S. citizenship now. Give college dreamers papers now. Humanity over nationalism. And to the phones to Anna in St. Paul. Hi, Anna. How does this affect your family?
Hi. So my mom is actually from Mexico, so I'm a first-generation child of an immigrant, and I'm also an immigration attorney.
Uh-huh.
So this will definitely impact the immigrant attorney community and immigration advocates as well as our clients. And I think of immediate concern is what's going to happen with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program, DACA. And according to within the advocate community, it's our understanding that it's somewhat likely or highly likely that this program will be suspended immediately by President-elect Trump on January 20th.
Yeah.
And that's of a huge concern.
I'm really glad you brought that up, Anna. I wanted to talk about that. Eduardo, DACA is the deferred action basic program, right?
Yes, indeed. And my understanding as well, my expectation as well, is that that will be ended pretty much immediately. And I think Trump has the ability to do this without further ado.
Are you saying with some kind of executive order? That's something that
yes.
President Obama did with an executive order.
Exactly.
Okay. What will that then mean for people who have been affected by DACA?
Well, that immediately puts them back in the shadows, right? So there is this. So again, the renewed fear of apprehension. I think this is going to be it's extremely important that you have now 11 million people in this country, 1 in 20 workers who woke up today feeling that they might be after them, right? That some enforcement agency is now going to be after them, perhaps even more intensely than they have been in recent years. So I think that the kind of the implications for a really, really large share of the population, which is spread throughout the country, is going to be remarkable. And I kind of I fail to understand how this will play through. But the feeling that we're going to have such a great number of people, which makes up the very large share of many communities, suddenly, you know, fearful of opening their door when they hear a knock is kind of crazy.
Linda, I do want to point out that President Obama deported a lot of people. Pew Research finds 2.4 million people deported out of the United States between 2009 and 2014, more than the Bush administration did.
Absolutely.
That context is important, too. Yeah.
Yes, he was. Now, let me just say one thing, and I think this would be a very important move, and it's one that I'm going to be advocating for within conservative circles. There is one group whom most Americans, I mean the overwhelming majority of Americans, believe ought to be given a chance to stay in the United States, and that is those who came as children. They did not willingly cross the border. Their parents brought them with them, and these are the so-called DACA children. Now, you know, it is possible that he will go in on his first day in office and sign an executive order reversing DACA, but it's possible that he won't. And one of the things that could happen is for some Republicans to get together and again to offer legislation that would give these young people the status that they now have under DACA, but do it legislatively. I think there are a lot of people who object to the fact that President Obama used executive orders to accomplish something that should have been accomplished through legislative action. But you have to remember that the whole idea of giving status to these children began as a Republican idea. Mm-hmm. It was Senator Orrin Hatch who proposed the first legislation that would have given status to those. So I'm hoping that as an olive branch, that even if he were to sign an executive order, that he would say at the same time, I am submitting legislation to Congress to accomplish this by legislation.
Linda Chavez is one of our guests this morning as we talk about what immigration policy looks like in President-elect Donald Trump's administration. She's a columnist and a writer and the president of the Becoming American Institute. And Eduardo Porter is with us. He writes about economics for the New York Times and was the Wall Street Journal Hispanic population reporter in L.A. I'm asking you this morning whether, as you recall what Donald Trump said about this issue, and there was a lot. This is one of those issues, unlike climate change, that got a lot of debate and conversation during the election campaign. Donald Trump made statements from the very day he announced about his concerns about our immigration policy. And now we're saying, how does he apply the rhetoric to the reality of the policy? And then I'd like to hear from you on whether you think the United States should allow more undocumented immigrants a way to full citizenship, an easier way to full citizenship. What about this idea of having to go back to the home country? What about President-elect Trump talked about a ban on Muslim immigration? I'd especially like to hear from you this morning if you are in a first or second generation immigrant family, because I understand your views vary on this. I think that's what was one of the items that came out of this election about where Hispanic and Latino voters ended up on this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieNPR, to Nadia in St. Louis Park. Hey, good morning, and thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Nadia, what are you thinking about?
Well, what I'm thinking about is I'm confused. I'm having an identity crisis here because I am a first-generation immigrant from the former Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and I'm also an immigration attorney.
Uh-huh.
And to echo on what everyone's been saying, you know, systemically speaking, what Mr. Trump is proposing, I don't know how it's going to work. As an immigration attorney, I do have colleagues that are on the removal side. They're on the trenches. They're the government attorneys that are litigating every single deportation order, a notice to appear, that's a document that's issued telling you to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, we are already wearing 15 different hats every day. We are clogged with work. Now if we're going to start deporting everyone, my God, how are we going to do it? The system is going to break. On the adjudication side, the judges are so overwhelmed. They're overworked. There's not enough judges. And the Department of Justice doesn't have the money to hire more judges. So I'm not quite sure how any of this is going to come together. On top of it, what I'd like to remind everyone, to all of my conservative colleagues and people that are hopefully listening that are conservative, the states that are red and the areas that were red are extremely underserved areas. They're areas where people don't work or live in. And who fills those jobs? Who does, at least in our state of Minnesota, the farming, the agricultural work? Immigrants, people that are coming that are happy to fill those jobs, predominantly people that are not of U.S. origin, and they're happy to do it. So for every single person that is voting red, has voted red from the rural area, remember that those are underserved areas. They're areas that are inherently have a shortage of workers.
Eduardo, is Nadia right about that?
Oh, indeed. There is this presumption in a lot of the anti-immigration rhetoric that the immigrants somehow go away, and then there's all these jobs available at a high wage for native-born Americans to take up. And that is, you know, an enormously stretched supposition. A lot of the jobs that are there happen because there is the immigrant labor force. So if the immigrant labor force disappears, it's likely that many of the jobs go too. The fact that California has a large produce economy in the San Joaquin Valley, for instance, is partly due to the fact that this labor force exists there. So one thing that one must consider when looking at, say, a future Trump America is in fact this: if you were to project what would happen to the American population if his policies as stated were to be put into effect, say deporting 11 million people and closing down immigration, the U.S. population would probably shrink by 2024. It would be somewhat like 25 million fewer people than what the census projects today the population is going to be. It would be an older population. The dependency ratio would be higher. There would be fewer workers sustaining more dependents. So there's this kind of assumption that things would turn rosy for the remaining people here. But immigrants make a contribution to this economy that would, you know, they would no longer make.
Linda, I wondered, given what Nadia and Eduardo are saying about the jobs that are filled, whether there is an opening for some kind of change that could be acceptable to the Jeff Sessions and the others in the House as well, that targets the guest worker, you know, that gives more, that opens up more of these guest worker program, something that could actually be meeting some of these concerns but be acceptable to Republicans.
Well, Eduardo is 100% right. And in fact, the right-of-center group American Action Forum actually did an economic model to what would happen to the U.S. economy if we deported the 11 million. They expect that over 2 years, it would cost the American economy $1 trillion and reduce the workforce by about 6.5%. So he's right. And so we have to figure out a way to make it better. One of the things that I have always emphasized is we spent all this time talking about illegal immigration, how to stop it. There really is a very simple way to stop illegal immigration, and that is to make it possible for people who fulfill certain jobs in our society, niches that Americans actually shun, to come in legally. And you can do that two ways. One, by a guest worker program, and those, you know, in things like agriculture, that might be possible. But also opening up more permanent resident visas to people based on skills, but not just high skills, also low skills, where Americans are frankly too well educated and are not willing to do jobs in meat processing. They're not willing to do jobs picking peaches on the western slope of Colorado. They're not willing to clean toilets and do some of the jobs that many new immigrants do. So we need to find a way to make it possible for more people to come legally. And that, frankly, would do a lot more to stem illegal immigration than any wall could possibly do.
But Eduardo, as I remember, George W. Bush was in favor of the things that Linda is talking about. And while it looked like he might make some progress on it, people that were unwilling to talk about any kind of amnesty or any kind of enlarging programs for undocumented people shut that down very quickly, and he couldn't move anything.
Well, yes. I mean, that was in 2007, right. The last time we came close to a grand bargain on immigration. It actually got quite far. It had the support of Ted Kennedy and the Democratic Party, but it leaked from several places. One of them was exactly the guest worker provision, where even though folks like in the AFL-CIO were reluctantly supportive of guest workers, the numbers that the ceiling that they put was actually quite low, and to my mind would have been breached almost immediately. So there were some flaws right there, and labor support was also not very strong. And on the right, on the Republican side, there was also a lot of resistance to the idea of legalizing unauthorized immigrants. So it kind of fell apart from various eras, from various points, but even if it hadn't fallen apart, I think it was designed incorrectly because the number of workers that it would have allowed in was actually very, very small. And I would agree with Linda on this, that the way that we know to stop illegal immigration is to find channels for this immigration to be legal. We've tried enforcement of the border for years and decades. We spend $30 billion on enforcing the border. There is already a wall that covers 700 miles of the 2,000 miles of border we have with Mexico. And that has really, evidently, this has not stopped illegal immigration.
Nicole says in Northeast Minneapolis, I'm married to an undocumented man who's been here for 20 years. We have kids. There is no path for my husband. We need reform. People think because we're legally married that he's a shoo-in, and he's not. Alyssa in Sioux Falls, South Dakota says, as a second-generation immigrant that doesn't like Trump or Clinton, I do support reform. I support border control. I don't think Trump is going to deport people. I think he'll take the money we give to Mexico and use it to build a wall, and that's okay. Linda, let me come back to you on the wall. See, that's what
I don't know what money we're giving to Mexico, by the way, except for drug enforcement, which is in our interest.
I thought he was at one point when Trump was pressed on this, he was talking about some kind of trade imbalance, you know, taking money that's already ours that we pay back. I don't even know if that exists, but it is clear that Mexico is not paying for a wall, isn't it?
Right. That's absolutely. And one of the things Trump was talking about doing was stopping remittances. That is the amount of money that individuals earn here in the United States and send home to their families. That, frankly, I think might even be unconstitutional. You know, our Constitution doesn't just protect people who are citizens. It protects all people who are within our borders. So I don't think he could do that. But look, the fact is we've got to find a way forward. I mean, I'm going to be 70 on my next birthday. I am already a recipient of Social Security, and I'm under the Medicare program. If we don't get a population of workers for the next generation, people like me are going to be in big trouble. And there are a whole lot of us in the United States.
Explain why that, how that connects, Linda, to Social Security.
Well, you know, people think that they've contributed to their Social Security fund and somehow they're getting their money back when they collect their checks. No, they're not. They are getting money from current workers who are paying Social Security taxes. That's where the money comes from. All of us who are fortunate enough to live to our actuarial expectations, including people who are high income earners and contributed a lot to Social Security, will over our lifetimes likely get back in benefit. It's more than we ever contributed. That means that we have to have an expanding workforce. It's a little bit like a pyramid scheme. You've got to have more people at the bottom contributing to be able to pay for those at the top. And as an aging population, those who are American born, we are much older than the newcomers who are coming in. We need to have an expanding workforce. And you're not going to have an expanding workforce if you cut off immigration.
Also want to, as you listen to the conversation and what our guests are saying and some of the questions I'm asking, if you voted for Donald Trump, I'd like to know specifically what you believe in what he says about his immigration policy, because I was hearing, you know, National Public Radio out there interviewing a lot of Trump supporters and people were saying, oh, I don't think the wall was real. Well, he has committed to that numerous times. So I'd like to know what you believe of what he says about immigration. Tracy says on Twitter, remember, Trump also says he's going to impose a federal government hiring freeze on the first day. Who will administer all these deportations? Steph, off the page.
Michelle Castillo says, I'm a legal immigrant. I will not be offended if there was a path to citizenship for people that have been here longer than 10 to 15 years, paying taxes, etc. It's not fair, but it's better than the economic impact of separating families and how that will affect our society, not to mention additional scars to our communities.
To the phones to Justin in Aurora. Hey, Justin, hi. Hi, Justin. Go ahead.
I just explain a little bit about the wall. From my understanding, I'm a Trump supporter.
Okay.
My wife has been waiting over a year now to come to this country legally. It's kind of upsetting that people just walk across the border and are here. Now, that being said, I think he should repeal DACA and provide them citizens with a path to legal citizenship. If we don't stop, we have to stop the problem. The people are here. Have them go, fill out the I-130, the same as my wife did. They all get documented, and then we're done with this. We have to build that wall to stop the drugs coming into this country.
Justin, I think you said something that resonates with some of the Trump supporters, which is your wife has been waiting a while to become a legal citizen, and she took the legal path to this, and it concerns you that other people do not. They just come across the border and they might end up with citizenship under some kind of reform. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, everybody wanted to change the word from illegal immigrant to undocumented worker, you know, undocumented immigrant. And then illegal is illegal. Now, as far as the deportation force, people are taking that out of context, too. He said that about criminals here in the country would be deported. If you have a felony record and you're an illegal immigrant, yeah, you should be scared.
Okay. Let me go back to Linda and Eduardo. Linda, to what Justin says about, I've got family members who are doing it legally. Why shouldn't everyone have to do it that way?
Well, I don't know where his family member is from, but first of all, he's talking about a spouse, so they have very high priority. Our current legal immigration system gives preference to people based on their family relationships. But if you are from certain countries, China, India, Mexico, for example, the Philippines, your wait to get into the United States is decades. It's not a year or two or three or four. It's decades. And again, in our own interest, if what we want is people who are capable of coming and contributing, paying taxes, paying those Social Security taxes that are important to our older population, then somebody who applies at the age of 20 and doesn't get in till he's 45 makes no sense. So that's part of the problem. People have a sense that there is this line and that people just have to get in line. There is no line for people who come from certain countries. The wait is enormous from those countries that have high levels of immigration. If you're from Europe, you don't have a long wait. But if you're from Mexico or, as I say, India or China, right now, the largest groups coming in legally are from India and China. Mexico has dropped to number three. And in fact, we have more Mexicans leaving the United States than we do coming in.
It's net migration back to Mexico, which is something
I like to
emphasize in these conversations. Eduardo, though, what Justin brings up may be the reason that Donald Trump did better by 2 percentage points overall than Mitt Romney did in 2012, and why Hispanic and Latino voters supported him at somewhere between 25% and 30% in states like Arizona.
Well, I think that you will find amongst the Latino population also folks who believe that it's unfair for Latinos to come here illegally and then become legalized in some way. But I would like to point out that it's not like I think your listener said, just walk across the border and then become legal. The walk across the border is a, 7-day affair in which many, many attempted and die along the way. In fact, one of the most dire consequences of the ramping up of border enforcement over the past 20 years has been on the number of deaths of immigrants trying to get in, which is actually quite high. So I wouldn't say it's like this just easy romp into the United States and then one fairly gets paperwork. As Linda points out, there is no line for certain types of immigrants, especially if somebody has been illegally in the United States. They must leave just automatically for 10 years before they could even try to get into this decade-long
line. Is it 10
line.
Years? Wow. Right. So you have to go back to your home country for 10 years at least, as it stands right now.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the other point I'd like to perhaps emphasize is, assuming that what one wants is to stop immigration from coming in, the next question is, well, is the policy proposed effective at doing that? And the policy proposed, we've been proposing variations of the wall since the 1980s. And they have really not addressed the problem, if the problem is illegal immigration. We had a very different policy from the 1950s, right after Operation Wetback that Linda was talking about. The number of guest worker visas that the United States gave to Mexican workers under the Bracero program for mostly agricultural work rose significantly to above 400,000 a year. And over the next decade, when there was a very large number of guest worker visas, illegal immigration plummeted extremely sharply.
Wow.
We don't have really good measures of mm-hmm. what illegal immigration was, but we do have measures of people that were caught trying to get in. And those numbers really dropped dramatically for the next 10 years. And you know when they started rising again? When the guest worker program was ended in 1964. Mm. Then we started seeing a big number increase again. And so between the mid-1960s and the mid-1980s, when we had the next big immigration reform, the number of the illegal immigration population in the U.S. grew by about 4.5 million people.
Carrie, could I just interject here?
Sure.
Because you did say something that I think needs to be corrected.
Okay.
It's out there. Everybody's saying it, and I think it's very wrong. And that is that somewhere between 25% and 30% of Hispanics voted for Donald Trump.
No, I said in some states, Linda.
In some states. But,
yeah.
But the tracking polls that actually have been very carefully done by one of the leading Hispanic pollsters show that it looks more like 17%. Voted, which actually I think makes more sense. Surely there are Hispanics who voted for Donald Trump. I don't think it was anywhere near the numbers we're seeing now. And we've seen this in every election. The exit polls actually usually overestimate Hispanic votes for Republican candidates, in part because all of the pollsters are speaking English, because some Hispanics are not, even if they speak English, they may not be comfortable with that as their first language. And so we have to wait to look at the better polls. And I think the better polls are going to show more like 20% or
okay,
less.
Okay, so let me be clear on this, because you're right. I did say that Donald Trump got a larger share of the Hispanic and Latino vote than Romney did, and you doubt that number.
I doubt that.
Okay.
I do.
Right.
I doubt that. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not me. It's the pollsters who were actually in the field and who were doing tracking polling, including on Election Day, and I think their numbers show much less.
Linda Chavez with us and Eduardo Porter with us this morning as we talk about what immigration policy might look like under President-elect Donald Trump's administration. Calling on you, if you voted for Donald Trump, if you like what he's been saying about immigration policy, I want to know what you want to see him enact, what you believe that he can actually get done in that immigration policy. Also appreciating hearing from you if you're in a mixed citizenship status family at the moment, if you're a first or second generation immigrant family, how you're thinking about this, what you're concerned about, perhaps what you like. 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. And we'll be right back to the conversation on the other side of news. Phil, what are you leading with this hour?
Hi, Carrie. The post-election rebound in stocks is continuing for a second day on Wall Street. Stocks have again surged higher, with the Dow gaining more than 150 points after the opening bell to move into record territory. Banks and other financial stocks rose the most, while utilities and real estate stocks lost ground. Former New York mayor and Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani is dismissing post-election protesters as, quote, a bunch of crybabies. On Fox News, Giuliani said most of the protesters are college-age students and seem to be 1% of the 1% of 1%. Protest marches were staged yesterday from New York to St. Paul to Seattle. Giuliani said Trump should tell them to calm down, and a year from now they will be living in a better country. Today's White House meeting involving Trump and President Obama won't be the only one involving the incoming administration. Trump will also meet with House Speaker Paul Ryan to talk about the Republican legislative agenda. Trump and Ryan have had a tense relationship. The White House says Trump's team will start working directly with federal agencies this week on the transition. Trump's team will get briefings related to the Defense Department, State Department, Treasury Department, and other agencies. The briefings will include budget details, flowcharts for staff, and other information. And in other news, authorities in Western Pennsylvania say one of two police officers shot early this morning has died. Authorities say the officers in the town of Cannonsburg were responding to the report of a domestic dispute and were ambushed as soon as they got to the scene. Cannonsburg is 20 miles southwest of Pittsburgh. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:41.
Next week is Thread Week on the show. We're going to talk a lot about books. I'm going to ask you for recommendations. We're going to talk about the best history books that put in perspective what is happening in the country right now. It's going to be great. Thread Week. Check it out at nprnews.org/thread.
Programming supported by the St. Paul Hotel, presenting a rendition of the live holiday radio broadcast, It's a Wonderful Life. Matinee performances with three-course luncheon and evening shows with a three-course dinner. Details at stpaulhotel.com.
Back to our conversation. Eduardo Porter with us from the New York Times. Linda Chavez with us from the Becoming American Institute. And to the phones here to Doug in Moose Lake. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, hi. I'm an avid, I can't even say I'm really an avid supporter of Trump at all. I mean, I really didn't decide I was voting for Trump until the day of the election, but I'm actually a veteran, and I've spent a lot of time in other countries. My biggest concern isn't so much about, is Trump going to get rid of all of these illegal immigrants? I kind of think that what he's going to end up doing is he's going to look at them and try to figure out who's got what kinds of jobs. Are they actually willing to pay the taxes and then put them through to be able to get their citizenship? And the ones that don't want to fit that description, they just get sent on home. My biggest concern is, and he has brought it up, is that when you go to another country like Spain or Great Britain or Germany or any of the Middle East, when you're there, you have to abide by 100% all of their laws. Mm-hmm. But when they come to this country, they don't have to. And the first one I would bring up would be Sharia law. The United States does not recognize this, yet immigrants are coming in and forcing this into our country. And I'm really kind of hoping that Trump actually prevents that and says, we are never recognizing this.
Okay, Doug, I don't know. I have not seen any evidence of Muslim immigrants forcing Sharia law on us. But let me take this to the guests. Eduardo, what would you say about Doug's concerns here?
Well, as you just pointed out, I have not heard of Sharia law being imposed in the United States. And so I really could not speak to that concern. More broadly, I also believe that, like other countries who expect immigrants to abide by their laws, the United States has the same expectation. And just as the United States might be in tension with the practices of some, you know, some people in the United States might not like the practices of some immigrant communities, these sorts of tensions have also arisen across Europe as immigration has picked up there. But about this specific charge, I'm unaware.
Linda, why does this persist? I've heard other people say this in connection with concerns about Muslim immigrants. There is no evidence of this.
Well, Sharia law, first of all, is, you know, administered through religious courts. Very Orthodox Jews, for example, go to arbiters about such things as divorce. They have to get something called a get if they wish to get a divorce. And that's a cultural practice. It doesn't in any way change the civil law, which requires you to go and actually go before a court and get a decree of divorce. But I do understand the concerns of people who worry that the current generation of immigrants are not assimilating. Part of that, I think, unfortunately, has been exacerbated by the left insisting on teaching Spanish-speaking students in their native language through bilingual education, which isn't really bilingual because it's native language instruction in some places, who've, you know, promoted the idea of multiculturalism. I think one of the things that causes the greatest backlash towards immigrants is the fear that they won't become American. Now, there really is no evidence that Latinos are not doing what every other group has done before them. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that shows that they are assimilating faster than the generation of Italian Jews, Poles, and others who came in the early part of the 20th century. They are learning English. Their children are fully fluent in English. They are adopting the norms. But, you know, I think we need to put more emphasis back in the unum in our national model, out of many, one. Unfortunately, I think we've sort of forgotten that in the past. And I think that would go a long way toward alleviating some of the fears like the caller that just spoke.
So your concern, and Eduardo, I want to bring you back in on this, or what you hear among people that believe in a stricter immigration policy is people come to this country and then they maintain their own traditions and beliefs from their home country, and they don't want to really join in the American Union. And as I just want to note this, as you said, there really is no statistical evidence that that isn't happening among immigrants, but it's a belief and a concern.
You're asking me?
Well, yeah.
Yes, I do think that it's a belief in a concern. I kind of think it's a bit of a misplaced concern. And I would like to compare, say, the American experience with that of European countries, where there's much more emphasis in this idea of assimilation. If, you know, immigrants in France are expected to take on kind of like French aesthetic choices in their, you know, beach wear and things like that, which the United States is much more liberal about allowing people to, you know, dress on the beach as they want. And so I would say that the assimilation experience in the United States is much, much greater than what one sees in these countries that demand much more of a taking on of the local customs. Latino communities in the United States, I think, as Linda points out, have assimilated immensely. And to my mind, the biggest assimilation machine that the United States has is quite a well-functioning labor market that has given these guys and these women jobs. So I think in terms of assimilation, the one thing that worries me most are policies that encourage people to hide from authorities and so on because they believe they are pursued. So the sort of like the policing of illegal immigration is kind of like detracts from the objective of assimilation. But I just wanted to point out that I think that the biggest concern out there, my interpretation of the angst about immigration amongst voters, is not necessarily about this issue of whether they are assimilating or not, but it's more about their understanding of an immigration system in the United States that just fails to do what it's supposed to do. So Americans have been told over the years and over the decades that we have this law that we can, you know, that we bar people who we don't want coming, we will keep them out. And that is really not what reality looks like to people. We have enormous number of people who are here illegally. And despite different rounds of immigration reform in 1965, in 1986, where, you know, we said, okay, this time we're going to fix it, it remains unfixed. And so this creates enormous skepticism.
Yeah, Eduardo, that's interesting. Because, Linda, let me come back to you on that. Do you believe that it's concerned that the laws aren't being obeyed? Or do you think it is more cultural? I tend to think it's more cultural.
I do think it's more cultural. I think when people, you know, I had a friend who's a liberal Democrat who got her ballot, and she called me and she said, Do you know that in Maryland, I have to have a Spanish ballot? You know, the ballot is printed in Spanish on one side and English on the other side. Now, she was a Hillary Clinton supporter, but that sort of startled her.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole English language thing is a big issue. Again, I think it's overwrought because Hispanics are learning English. I mean, if you had dropped into the Lower East Side in Manhattan in 1913, you would have thought the Jews were going to continue to be Yiddish-speaking. They weren't going to be very educated. They were going to be poor. That didn't happen. They moved up the economic ladder. They all assimilated to English, even though at that time they were reading Yiddish language newspapers and attending Yiddish theater. The same is true with Hispanics. If you're looking at a new immigrant community, the newcomers may be watching Univision or Telemundo, but their kids are watching English language programming. It takes a little time to assimilate, but people do. And particularly if you want to move up that ladder, English is absolutely the key to that. And I mean, listen to the two of us. Eduardo and I are both talking to you in English. That
luckily,
is what happens. Right.
I've tried to learn Spanish many times, Linda, to no avail.
And I have to tell you, English is my first and frankly my only language. I don't speak Spanish well. I don't speak French well, although I've studied them both.
Saeed says in Egan, called to say, people should understand what Sharia law is. It's a problem with a lack of knowledge. This type of perception is dangerous. And I got a tweet from a professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota who says, no Islamic nation operates according to Sharia law. Sharia law is very limited, mostly to domestic law like marriage. And Steph, off the page.
We got a lot of comments about Sharia law.
Did we?
I won't name them. I won't read them all. Paul says, I would grant temporary custody, temporary status to some, but we need the structure of the old. My wife went through immigration and naturalization when there were medical exams, sponsorship guarantees, and I promised to send her back if she was convicted of a crime. And he also asks, why aren't we talking about undocumented Irish in Boston and New York?
Okay. To the phones to Callie in Minneapolis. Hi, Callie.
Hi there. I just wanted to start out by saying I really appreciate this conversation that's so thoughtful.
Good.
And calm. Because immigration, I know, in my experience, is really an emotional debate most of the time. So thank you for having the platform.
Yeah, thank you.
So I heard you read a message from Nicole in Minneapolis a few minutes ago, and I actually know her online. And we know each other because we're in the same situation. My husband also is undocumented. He's from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
There is no path for him. We're either need to stay living in the shadows here in the United States, which is what we're doing, or we could be separated and he could serve his 10-year bar in Mexico, or I could exile to Mexico to preserve the family unity. Those are our only options at the moment.
What does your husband, Kelly, do about work and, you know?
He works. There are companies that don't do E-Verify, and so it's not hard to get a job and to work and to work lots of hours. What doesn't happen to him but happens a lot of the time is workplace, what do you want to call it, like people being taken advantage of because of their status.
Mm-hmm.
And being worked a lot of hours, you know, not being paid for their overtime and things like that. So thankfully he's not in that situation, but we have friends that experience that.
But if you were, I assume that you've already tried to apply for citizenship for him or not. But
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're in the process. It's an indefinite process for us right now. All I have to do is call the National Visa Center once a year.
Wow.
And let them know that we intend to keep our case open.
Wow.
And
yeah,
that's just what we do because we know that once our case proceeds to the next step, he will be able to leave in three for a minimum of 10 years.
Hey, Kelly, I really appreciate the call. Eduardo, I also thought that if you had a spouse, no matter where you were from, you moved way up in the process. Apparently you don't.
Well, you do move up in the process, but you still have this 10-year window that was imposed in the mid-1990s. This wasn't always the case. But yes, if you're a spouse and you haven't been here without papers, then you do move very, very quickly. You get a green card fairly quickly. It's much quicker than if you have children under 18, that also happens very quickly, but it becomes a longer wait the further removed your relative is. So I think if you're a Mexican brother, you are talking of several decades before you can get your residency.
Eduardo, I really appreciate the time and the insight today and the benefit of your reporting. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much. It was very interesting.
Linda, last question for you here, and this is back on the politics of this. When the last big push for immigration reform happened, the Republican-led House decided that they were going to break up the bill and pass it piecemeal, and that didn't work, and other attempts to get it through the House haven't worked. Can you see any indication that anything that is really meaningful can get through that House?
Well, it depends. I mean, if a President Trump decided to put power under a bill that would provide for a guest worker program that might allow for legalization of the children who came here when it was no fault of their own, I think you would see something pass because you'd have a lot of Democratic votes, and I think you'd certainly have enough Republican votes to get it passed.
But do you remember the Hastert rule when they were— Boehner invoked that, didn't he?
But the problem is, what a lot of Republicans feared is that anything they passed would be ignored and not enforced properly by President Obama. Those fears will now be put aside. So I'm hopeful that we can move forward on this, but a lot will depend on who's in charge. If you have someone like Jeff Sessions in charge of Department of Homeland Securities, I think it's going to be a problem. He is just part of the anti-immigration group in Washington. He works closely with Numbers USA, FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. These folks aren't just anti-immigrant. They are anti-population. They want to see a smaller United States. And if that's the man in charge, then my hopes will be dashed.
It does sound like, though, you expect not some kind of large and sweeping reform. It sounds like you expect individual bills and maybe limited to how effective they are or how effective they are overall on immigration policy.
I think you'll see a lot of emphasis on border security, and that's fine so long as it is also coupled with some legal immigration reform. Because as I've said all along, you can't stop illegal immigration unless you give a way for people to come legally.
Linda, real pleasure to talk again. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
And the insight. Linda Chavez, columnist, writer, former staff member in the Reagan administration, now president of the Becoming American Institute. Hey, if you had to leave before that conversation, before we wrap this up, or you couldn't get in on the discussion through the hour that we talked about immigration policy, you can always find it on my podcast, nprnews.org, and check it out there. And you can search for NPR News with Carrie Miller on podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts on iTunes.